This is the Nietzsche Podcast. Quote, every nation is put to shame if one points out such a wonderfully idealized company of philosophers as that of the early Greek masters, Thales, Anaximander, Heraclitus, Parmenides, Anaxagoras, Empedocles, Democritus, and Socrates. All those men are integral, entire, and self-contained, and hewn out of one stone. Severe necessity exists between their thinking and their character. They are not bound by any convention, because at that time, no professional class of philosophers and scholars existed. They all stand before us in magnificent solitude as the only ones who then devoted their life exclusively to knowledge. End quote. Philosophy in the Tragic Age of the Greeks is one of the more obscure texts in Friedrich Nietzsche's corpus. There are many good reasons for this. It is unfinished and ends abruptly. It was never published, and it concerns subject matter that is not as immediately accessible as Nietzsche's more popular writings. You will not find his major concepts in this work, such as the will to power or the critique of metaphysics, except insofar as those ideas appear in the background, inchoate, unnamed, not yet fully formed in Nietzsche's thought. In Nietzsche's interpretation of these pre-Platonic philosophers of ancient Greece, we find the starting place for his later philosophical career. The inspiration for many of those great ideas that we mentioned can arguably be found in his exegesis of these extraordinary figures from the Hellenic world from the 6th through the 4th century BC. Nietzsche wrote this essay in the years 1873 and 1874, while he was still an academic studying classical philology at Basel. Notably, he'd already written his Birth of Tragedy by this time, but that book was not intended as a work of philosophy. Admittedly, one of the main criticisms of Birth of Tragedy at the time of its publication was that it departed significantly from philological rigor. Nietzsche lapses into Schopenhauerian philosophy in that book, at other times into adoration for Wagner. But nevertheless, it must be said, Birth of Tragedy is not a work of pure philosophy. That was not Nietzsche's goal in writing it. He did set out to write a text in the field of philology. However, the project in Philosophy in the Tragic Age of the Greeks is somewhat similar to Birth of Tragedy, insofar as in that book, Nietzsche had looked to the Greeks as a counterpoint to modern society, used the exploration of their art, the Greek dramatic tragedy, and the values behind it as a means of understanding art itself, and for that matter, understanding valuing itself. Philosophy in the Tragic Age of the Greeks is much the same in this method, only that instead of Greek drama, the topic is Greek philosophy. Nietzsche set the question to himself as to how it was that philosophy came to be in the Greek world. But Philosophy in the Tragic Age of the Greeks is a rather different book from Birth of Tragedy, in that it is not a work of philology. It comes out of his study of philology, but Nietzsche is really engaging with the philosophical ideas as these figures put them forward. If you've been listening to the podcast for a while, you already know the phrase pre-Platonic, but if you haven't heard that phrase before or you need a refresher, Nietzsche comes up with this term to replace the label pre-Socratic. Nietzsche's argument is that Socrates has more in common with these figures, usually called pre-Socratic, than he does with his own student, Plato. The point of this terminology is to include Socrates among these earlier figures, but it is also to divide him from Plato. The main reason for this is that Socrates is one of these single-minded sages, as Nietzsche calls them. Like the other pre-Platonics, he is hewn from a single stone, whereas Plato is a systematizer who borrows from multiple philosophers. Plato's thought and also his character is a mix of multiple types that came before him, rather than an original expression of one coherent spirit, in Nietzsche's view. Quote, as a man, too, Plato mingles the features of the royally secluded, all-sufficing Heraclitus, of the melancholy, compassionate, and legislatory Pythagoras, and of the psycho-expert dialectician Socrates. All later philosophers are such hybrid characters. Wherever something one-sided does come into prominence with them, as in the case of the Cynics, it is not a type, but a caricature. End quote. Nietzsche argues that when we come into contact with a single-minded philosophy, we are confronted with something which is considered somewhat absurd from the standpoint of our modern world. That which survives over the ages is, whether we like it or not, dependent on the zeitgeist, the movement of the collective mind, and what the multitude considers relevant in a given time and place. Nietzsche suggests, for example, that Schopenhauer's magnum opus, The World as Will and Representation, has been rendered waste paper by the progressive feeling brought about by the scientific revolutions which are in full swing in Nietzsche's time. And anyone with a sense that there is a real progression and development in the course of the phenomenal world would naturally dispense with such a pessimist as Schopenhauer, who doesn't believe in progress. This is just one example, and Nietzsche suggests that we accept this state of affairs, like Goethe, who said, quote, "Let no one complain about and grumble at things vile and mean. They are the real rulers, however much this be gainsaid." End quote. In other words, the crowd and its zeitgeist is far more powerful than the truth, and philosophy has never been a course of development in which we grasp the truth more and more completely. Nietzsche's acceptance of this very state of affairs is, somewhat ironically, an appeal to the kind of anti-progressive pessimism that Nietzsche just said the mean and vulgar crowd has dispensed with. Nietzsche's saying this is an eternal, unchanging truth, that what the multitude believes never has anything to do with the philosopher's search for knowledge, their devotion of their life to knowledge. That is not what will determine what is in vogue. Nietzsche writes, this is in section 2 of Philosophy in the Tragic Age of the Greeks, quote, "A time which suffers from the so-called general education, but has no culture and no unity of style in her life, hardly knows what to do with philosophy, even if the latter were proclaimed by the very genius of truth in the streets and marketplaces. She rather remains at such a time the learned monologue of the solitary rambler, the accidental booty of the individual, the hidden closet secret, or the innocuous chatter between academic senility and childhood. Nobody dare venture to fulfill in himself the law of philosophy. Nobody lives philosophically with that simple manly faith which compelled an ancient, wherever he was, whatever he did, to deport himself as a Stoic when he had once pledged his faith to the Stoa. All modern philosophizing is limited politically and regulated by the police to learned semblance. Thanks to governments, churches, academies, customs, fashions, and the cowardice of man, it never gets beyond the sigh, if only, or beyond the knowledge, once upon a time there was. Philosophy is without rights. Therefore, modern man, if he were at all courageous and conscientious, ought to condemn her, and perhaps banish her with words similar to those by which Plato banished the tragic poets from his state." End quote. Once again, there's an irony to Nietzsche's musings here. He's tacitly accepting the notion that modernity is anti-philosophical. It would reject such a way of thinking as that of the pre-Platonic philosopher, who is hewn from one stone, uncompromising, a coherent, integral expression of a tyrannical idea. Philosophy has been relegated to the fringes. Modernity regards such an uncompromising attempt at rendering the world in one's own image as absurdity or insanity or even dangerous. Philosophy generally has no power over public opinion, over public institutions. And in such an age as our own that we might designate as a public age, philosophy therefore seems destined to perish. Only a facsimile of it remains among the senile academics. The public mind moves according to what is fashionable, and all that we find in philosophy is unfashionable. We could put it like that. And yet, by authoring this very work, Nietzsche is not passively accepting this state of affairs. He's in fact setting himself up against it. He's positioning himself as untimely. And it might be justified to call this work a preliminary, untimely meditation. Nietzsche's purpose in writing this work, as he explains in the preface, is that by presenting us with these remarkable figures from antiquity, we might be able to see that, quote, that mode of life, of viewing human affairs at any rate, has existed once and is therefore possible, end quote. Accordingly, when Nietzsche describes this series of thinkers, they are striking both in their difference from us and our modern ways of thinking, and in their difference from the ways of thinking that preceded them, the ways of thinking that were common in their own culture. Each such philosopher is an archetypal figure, a man who stands for one big idea. Whatever other constituent ideas may be included, they are really just further elaborations on the central idea. In this same preface, Nietzsche admits, most philosophies are useful only to their creator, and to subsequent generations, they just look like one big mistake. And accordingly, it's easy to dismiss the pre-Platonics, as many have throughout history, for example, daring to make hypotheses about nature without having first bothered to invent the scientific method. But as Nietzsche would go on to argue in his later works, such as Beyond Good and Evil, we haven't changed all that much, insofar as philosophers are governed by one ruling thought. Philosophy is a confession, a revelation of who one is. The pre-Platonics do this, but without any of the adulteration, any of the sophistication of the modern philosopher, who may have, for example, ideas about the dialectic, that the objective truth can be found through this process of logical investigation. In Nietzsche's understanding, the pre-Platonics are more artistic in their approach. Their philosophies are a reflection of what is within them. They do not proceed by careful steps, but by great leaps. What each one of them expresses, in other words, is a will, a tendency, a type. In this sense, the only difference between us and them is that this single-mindedness is not obscured by the pretensions of a philosophical system. These men, accordingly, are, quote, strangers to us, end quote. Nietzsche writes that whoever takes any pleasure in learning about extraordinary men, however, will find pleasure in the strange thought of these figures, however erroneous we may find it to be from our modern standpoint. This is because, quote, they all have in them one point which is irrefutable, a personal touch and color. One can use them in order to form a picture of the philosopher, just as from a plant growing in a certain place, one can form conclusions as to the soil, end quote. If we recall Nietzsche's work, Birth of Tragedy, and especially the comments that he appended to that later work in his 1886 preface that he added, Nietzsche indicates that the appearance of philosophy in the Hellenic world is something of a riddle. The theoretical approach to life, represented by Socrates and Plato, this was seen as a complete inversion of the tragic way of life that came before it. Nietzsche argues in Twilight of the Idols that the Athenian noblemen were creatures of instinct, who never knew the reason for the things they did and the things they believed, and Socrates' interrogation of them, seeking for such reasons, speaks to the decline of Greek society. The very fact that their values had become questionable, Socrates is a symptom of this. The creation of philosophy seems like an odd thing when we consider the culture of the Hellenic Greeks, who considered such knowledge to be, quote, useless. That was their word for the kind of knowledge that we would class as philosophical because it was not knowledge that one used for any art or craft. It was not knowledge of how to appease the gods through the sacrificial rites, nor was it knowledge of how to fight or win battles. Philosophical knowledge, knowledge about the truth of the objective world, as we might put it in our own vocabulary, was something the Greeks were suspicious of. The tragic age of the Greeks we could place from roughly 700 BC to around the time when Socrates died, around 399. That was an age defined by the culture of tragedy. It was more broadly a period in which the Greek was instructed primarily by art and poetry. The people entrusted with teaching virtue to the Greek citizens, to impart the knowledge to them of how to live and how to act, what the gods were like, and so on, were the playwrights and the poets. Later, there was a formalized school that instructed people in rhetoric and oratory. These were called the Sophists, and they represented another such cultural institution entrusted with educating the polis. So how was it that this audacious figure called the philosopher could ever arise on Greek soil? How could the man who pursues worthless knowledge carve out a place for his existence in Hellenic society? The daunting challenge of such a prospect speaks all the more strongly to the power of these philosophical ideas, and more importantly, to the power of the imposing character, the will of the figures that expounded them. Nietzsche, in his understanding of the pre-Platonic philosophers, comes to see them as a type classed among the artists. The philosopher creates a new, unified picture of the world, but through means of concepts. He overcomes the mythic preliminary stage of philosophizing found in the theologies and cosmogonies. He overcomes the sporadic, aphoristic wisdom found in the writing of the poets and the utterances of the oracles. He goes beyond all of the natural sciences by turning his attention to metaphysics. These figures are extraordinary precisely because they create the art of philosophizing in such a resolutely unself-reflective age, an age of unreason, pride, the pitiless pursuit of worldly power. The fact that such philosophers flourished during this age makes their appearance the most noteworthy of all such appearances of philosophers throughout history, throughout the many different civilizations and different epochs of human history. This meditation on the figure of the Greek philosopher can be seen as a prefiguration of Nietzsche's later thoughts on the problem of science. This begins in earnest with Socrates, but seems to have its roots in these earlier figures. Or the role of the philosopher in a healthy society. This is the philosopher presented as a healthy figure rather than a sick figure. The very concern with sickness and health bears resemblance to Nietzsche's mature philosophy, in which health and sickness become interchangeable with strength and weakness, or with vitality and decline. The core question of philosophy in the tragic age of the Greeks might be put this way. Assuming that most examples we have of philosophers are sick examples, that is to say, they arose during a sick period of civilization, what then is a healthy philosopher? What does the philosopher mean to a healthy society? Accordingly, one alternative title to the work that Nietzsche explored as an option was The Philosopher as Physician to Culture. Nietzsche is not just using the term physician in the sense of a medical doctor, someone that you see just when you're sick. When the physiology stops working, you go to the doctor. Ironically, one could say that's a sick person's view of medicine. We might consider Nietzsche's remark in his lecture on Pythagoras that, quote, the theory and practice of the physicians were considered further advancement for gymnastic trainers, end quote. The physician was seen more like a craftsman who worked on and perfected the physique. He didn't just fix it when it was broken. The physician's research, his knowledge, furthered the art of the personal trainers who produced Olympic athletes. The Greeks had made an entire social institution out of creating the ideal physique, and the knowledge of the physician was used for this purpose. And thus, even though Nietzsche didn't ultimately end up using this title, again, he didn't even publish the essay, we can still see the parallel there. The philosopher is a physician to culture, meaning that in a healthy time, the philosopher is not just the person who fixes culture when it's broken. The philosopher is the one who acquires the knowledge of what cultural health itself constitutes, and thus brings a healthy culture into greater and greater health. Nietzsche writes at the beginning of this essay, quote, "Whenever philosophy showed itself helping, saving, prophylactic, it was with healthy people. It made sick people still more ill. If ever a nation was disintegrated and but loosely connected with the individuals, never has philosophy bound these individuals closer to the whole. If ever an individual was willing to stand aside and plant around himself the hedge of self-sufficiency, philosophy was always ready to isolate him still more and to destroy him through isolation. She is dangerous where she is not in her full right, and it is only the health of a nation, but not that of every nation, which gives her this right. Let us now look around for the highest authority as to what constitutes the health of a nation. The Greeks, as the truly healthy nation, have justified philosophy once and for all by having philosophized, and that indeed more than all other nations." End quote. Nietzsche abandoned this essay in order to focus his efforts on a new project, critiquing David Strauss. This would become the first untimely meditation, and Nietzsche would write and publish three more of them. These are usually considered his first purely philosophical works. But had Nietzsche finished this essay instead, Philosophy in the Tragic Age of the Greeks likely would have been the first. And therefore, I tend to see this work as Nietzsche's first foray into philosophy, his first purely philosophical essay. As to why he did not finish it, there's a number of possibilities that we won't go into here. They mostly involve speculation. I guess the short version that we could say is that Nietzsche may have wished to take on subject matter that was entirely outside of his scholarly career as a philologist. So maybe he wanted to leave the Greeks behind as a primary subject. He might have wanted to impress the Wagners by attacking David Strauss, a figure for whom they bore some dislike. Whatever the case may be, this essay unfortunately ends after a discussion of the philosopher Anaxagoras, and it thus leaves out the final three figures that he mentions, Democritus, Empedocles, and Socrates. Thankfully, we have Nietzsche's lectures on the pre-Platonic philosophers, the text of which has been assembled, translated, and published in what seems to have been a daunting undertaking all its own. Those lectures contain many of the same ideas and descriptions as appear in this essay, and Philosophy in the Tragic Age of the Greeks is clearly based, at least in part, on those lectures. Even some of the phrasing remains the same from the lecture notes to the essay. Nietzsche's focus is a bit different in the lectures, though. For one, the lectures are primarily concerned with a narrative about the emergence of scientific materialism. Nietzsche argues that this process, as it develops in Hellenic civilization, is mirrored in European Enlightenment civilization. Nietzsche draws parallels between the scientific minds of modern Europe and the pre-Platonics, and he elucidates the thought of the pre-Platonics by comparison with scientific experiments and new theories in physics, that is, new for Nietzsche's time. I have, in the past, called the book that Nietzsche had originally planned, based on these lectures, the most important book that Nietzsche never wrote, because so many of the underpinnings of his later ideas are in the background of those lectures. You see how he's in dialogue with the Greek philosophers, how his philosophy is in many ways a response to them. And there is a surprising importance to the philosophy of science, which is a large part of this. If you want to know more about that aspect of Nietzsche's interpretation of the pre-Platonics, I recommend you listen to the episodes from season 2 about that topic entitled Descent into Materialism and the World as Will to Power and Nothing Besides. Those episodes primarily cover the pre-Platonic lectures, which should be regarded as essentially another iteration of the same project of Nietzsche's, albeit approached from a slightly different angle. Today, instead, we're going to focus on the incarnation of those ideas in the form of this essay, Philosophy in the Tragic Age of the Greeks, in which his engagement with the pre-Platonics is a bit more straightforward philosophical. The meta-narrative concerning the development of science, it is still there, but it's more in the background, and Nietzsche's focus is primarily on representing this sequence of fascinating personalities to us. Nevertheless, since the essay is unfinished, and I do want to cover the final names that he planned to include here, will look to his lecture notes to fill out the descriptions of the final figures Empedocles and Democritus. I'm not going to devote a section to Socrates here. This is not because Socrates is unimportant, but because we've already spent numerous episodes discussing Nietzsche's interpretation of Socrates. Nietzsche on Socrates would require an episode all its own, which we've already done, so including such a discussion here would not do the subject justice, and it would also be redundant. It should also be said that Nietzsche's lecture notes concern many other figures that we will not discuss. We're going to strictly concern ourselves with the names that Nietzsche lists off at the beginning of the essay. Nietzsche, I think correctly, judges those that he excludes from this essay to be merely secondary figures. They are either elaborators within the school of someone else, or significant only as the forerunner of someone else. So that we can help make sense of this procession of figures, and remember how they fit in with one another, I'd like to begin by breaking the pre-Platonics down into categories or phases of pre-Platonic thought. Thales, Anaximander, and Heraclitus are what I would call the first cosmologists. Their primary concern is with understanding the material world and explaining the material world. They have a monistic tendency, and they believe in arising and passing away. That is to say that things come into and go out of being. These are the three figures that we're going to talk about in this first episode. Then there are the Eleatics. The sole figure who represents them here is Parmenides. The Eleatics believe that non-being doesn't exist, that things don't arise and pass away, and that only being exists. Therefore, change is impossible, motion is impossible, and the senses are illusory. Finally, there are the Pluralists, Anaxagoras, Empedocles, and Democritus, who believe not in being, but beings, plural. Multiple existence, multiple types of matter that interact and transform. The Pluralists are concerned with explaining the basic principles of these interactions and transformations. So, the first cosmologists, the Eleatics, and the Pluralists are the major categorizations of thought here. You could categorize them according to a different schema. These are simply my arbitrary distinctions that we're making here for the purposes of helping to better remember how these thinkers interact and relate to one another. They're not essential designations, it's just a helpful mnemonic. And so without further ado, I'll attempt to fulfill Nietzsche's purposes in this project, albeit in podcast form, of giving you a portrait of each of these significant pre-Platonic figures. We'll begin with Thales. Thales of Miletus, circa 585 BC. Thales leaves us no writings in his own hand, and we know his work only from later chroniclers who have preserved something of his thought. Perhaps the most interesting thing about Thales is that he's likely not a Greek, but a Phoenician. The Mediterranean world allowed for the intermingling of all sorts of different thinkers and doctrines as Thales studied and taught in Egypt. He is not just a philosopher, but also a scientist. Again, it has to be emphasized. The social institution of philosophy didn't exist at this time. There was not a recognizable, familiar type called the philosopher, because Thales is the first such type. The chief contributions of Thales to the sciences were geometrical proofs, but his chief contribution to posterity is nothing having to do with math or science. Thales' significance is that he creates philosophy by proposing a metaphysical hypothesis. He proposes a theory about the origin and basis of the world, that all is water. Quote, Greek philosophy seems to begin with a preposterous fancy, with the proposition that water is the origin and mother womb of all things. Is it really necessary to stop there and become serious? Yes, and for three reasons. Firstly, because the proposition does enunciate something about the origin of things. Secondly, because it does so without figure and fable. Thirdly, and lastly, because in it is contained, although only in the chrysalis state, the idea. Everything is one. The first mentioned reason leaves Thales still in the company of religious and superstitious people. The second, however, takes him out of this company and shows him to us as a natural philosopher. But by virtue of the third, Thales becomes the first Greek philosopher. If he had said, out of water, earth is evolved, we should only have a scientific hypothesis, a false one, though nevertheless difficult to refute. But he went beyond the scientific. In his presentation of this concept of unity through the hypothesis of water, Thales has not surmounted the low level of the physical discernments of his time, but at the best overlapped them. The deficient and unorganized observations of an empiric nature which Thales had made as to the occurrence and transformations of water, or to be more exact, of the moist, would not in the least have made possible or even suggested such an immense generalization. That which drove him to this generalization was a metaphysical dogma which had its origin in a mystic intuition, and which, together with the ever-renewed endeavors to express it better, we find in all philosophies, the proposition, everything is one, end quote. So Thales is the first philosopher because he leads the way in the methodology of representing the unity of existence. His intuition, all is one, is at the root of all philosophy, so long as we agree with Nietzsche in classifying philosophy as a kind of art that involves the reflection of external existence in the mirror of the internal. And since our internal world, when rendered artistically, is always the work of an impulse, that means it is always ruled by a single tyrannical thought, because all such impulses want to be ruler and act tyrannically. In Thales' case, all is water. This is not a scientific hypothesis, strictly speaking, even though Thales does literally mean that all physical material we encounter is a transformation of water, or its rarefaction. But Thales attempts something metaphysical when he tries to articulate the notion that there is a substance to being, a universal reality that forms the ground of all being. The remarkable thing about Thales is that he allows his scientific drive for inquiry to manifest itself in this artistic way. The philosopher is essentially artistic because he renders an image. It is an image formed through the concept rather than set into marble, but nevertheless it is a representation that comes from the subjectivity of the philosopher. The claim, all is water, would not stand up to empirical scrutiny. Rather, it is thinking that partakes readily of a poetic license. Nietzsche says that, quote, what the verse is to the poet, dialectic thinking is to the philosopher. He snatches at it in order to hold fast his enchantment, in order to petrify it, end quote. Nietzsche invites us to consider an artist contemplating the waters flowing and breaking as a waterfall splashes down a mountain. Quote, one might imagine the creating artist standing near a waterfall and seeing in the forms which leap towards him an artistically prefiguring game of the water with human and animal bodies, masks, plants, rocks, nymphs, griffins, and with all existing types in general, so that to him the proposition everything is water is confirmed. The thought of Thales has rather its value, even after the perception of its indemonstrableness, the very fact that it was meant unmythically and unallegorically. End quote. So the important distinction between the philosopher and all the types that have come before is the fact that he does not lapse into myth and story. It is not that Thales reasons through a dispassionate logic to reach an indisputable conclusion. Rather, Thales takes a poetic leap. He overcomes the personifications, metaphors, and cosmogonies of Greek culture. He doesn't accomplish this through the sciences. In some sense, the question that Thales concerns himself with, what is the origin of all things, is not a scientific question in the first place, and the sciences cannot help him here. His answer draws upon the phenomenal world as an explanation of the phenomenal. This choice is no more or less justified than the mythological, we could say, but that's precisely why his great leap is so remarkable in contradistinction to his time. In a culture where everyone views the origin of all things as the act of personified deities, as the work of Zeus and Apollo and Aphrodite, Thales looks to a natural phenomenon as the origin of all things. Nevertheless, we can perhaps see the logic in suggesting water as the origin, in spite of its indemonstrableness, as Nietzsche puts it, since we could easily see how, when water is absorbed by the soil, plants grow. We need water to survive. All living beings do. The oceans are teeming with life. It seems as though water is the thing from which living things spring. We can also see how wet or moist soil eventually hardens and dries. One might begin to get the notion that once there was only water, there was an undifferentiated mass of that which is moist, and then the earth dried and hardened out of it, the living things grew out of it, even evaporation could be seen as the explanation for how the air is formed. It is heated water, and so on and so forth. And so we see in Thales a mind which is not chaotic and irrational. There's a logic to his approach. We could call it a form of artistic reasoning. There's an important sense in which the philosopher is not just a development on the scientist. He's not just a development on the religious type, and he's not, strictly speaking, just an artist. The philosopher draws on aspects of all three of these and simultaneously leaps beyond all three. He is arbitrarily creative like the artist. He follows his reason like the scientist, and he aims to encompass the whole of reality like the mythmakers. It's not easy to summarize this relationship in one sentence, but perhaps we can say the philosopher perceives, maybe even just on some intuitive or unconscious level, that what's common to all three types is a depiction of reality. And the philosopher aims to do the same thing, but in his own way, in a new way. Nietzsche writes, quote, "When Thales says everything is water, man is startled up out of his worm-like mauling of and crawling about among the individual sciences. He divines the last solution of things and masters through this divination the common perplexity of the lower grades of knowledge. The philosopher tries to make the total chord of the universe re-echo within himself and then to project it onto ideas outside himself. Whilst he is contemplative like the creating artist, sympathetic like the religionist, looking out for ends and causalities like the scientific man, whilst he feels himself swell up to the macrocosm, he still retains the circumspection to contemplate himself coldly as the reflex of the world. He retains that cool-headedness which the dramatic artist possesses when he transforms himself into other bodies, speaks out of them, and yet knows how to project this transformation outside himself into written verses." End quote. So, a couple things to comment on in that passage. Again, Nietzsche speaks at length of the blending of the artistic, scientific, and religious type within the philosopher. The notion of the scientific man boring through the earth like a worm is an allegory that Nietzsche would return to time and again. In his essay on Truth and Lies in the Extra-Moral Sense, he talks of the sciences as digging in their own individual mine shafts. Science is a bringing down of one's perspective to the level of the smallest detail. The various sciences, as each discipline becomes specialized, they become concerned with smaller and smaller distinctions and nuances. To encompass the whole of reality is, in some sense, unscientific, and thus any time somebody dares to give a description of existence itself, or the universe itself, one necessarily has to go beyond the sciences and become philosophical, even as they draw upon the power of the sciences to seek out the causes and reasons for everything. That is it's a leap into the creative, because creative license always must be used, and that's true no matter how much science one knows or brings into their description of the world. To say, for example, "We are all molecules in motion," perhaps the kind of phrase we might hear from a modern scientific materialist. Well, That phrase singles out one level of material existence, the level of the molecule, and makes that primary. It also tables the mystery of why there's motion at all, simply asserts that motion exists as a kind of truism. And so in the statement, we are molecules in motion, we have a selective focus on one part of reality while obscuring the rest, which is an artistic choice. And so however clinical such a phrasing may sound, a poetic distortion of reality takes place in that phrasing. Further, such a statement posits motion as a brute fact. It becomes a sort of axiomatic mystery of existence. So we have an artistic claim and a religious sensibility contained in such an apparently scientific statement. Such a statement is a great leap. Thales, as preposterous as his initial assumption seems, is doing the same thing. Nietzsche writes, quote, "Thus the expression of every deep philosophical intuition by means of dialectics and scientific reflection is, it is true, on the one hand the only means to communicate what has been seen, but on the other hand it is a paltry means, and at the bottom a metaphorical, absolutely inexact translation into a different sphere and language," end quote. Considering metaphorical thinking, the metaphor of the leap to describe philosophy is particularly important in this essay. Nietzsche uses the metaphor of two men attempting to cross a river by different methods. The first man, quote, "light-footed, leaps over it using the stones and swinging himself upon them ever further and further, though they precipitously sink into the depths behind him," end quote. The second man calculates instead that he must first, quote, "build a pathway which will bear his heavy, weary step," end quote. The first man is like Thales and all the pre-Platonics that we will discuss in this essay. The second man represents Plato and all those philosophers who come after Plato, the post-Platonics. Thales shows the way forward with his hypothesis because the whole of reality is depicted in the form of the concept, and Nietzsche understands this to be a creative, arbitrary, artistic act rather than a dialectical movement of the mind towards a greater truth, or however a Platonist or a Hegelian philosopher might understand it. This is the significance of Thales. He's the first one of the Greek canon of writers who does this. And so in spite of the fact that there are no Thalians around today promoting the aquatic theory of material existence, in some sense, we are all Thalians, to the extent that any philosopher who tries to encompass reality in an idea is following the course of Thales. To sum up this figure and his significance, Nietzsche writes, quote, "Thales saw the unity of the existent, and when he wanted to communicate this idea, he talked of water," end quote. Anaximander, from 610 to 546 BC. Anaximander is also from Miletus. He was a mathematician and an astronomer. According to Diogenes Laertius, quote, "he was the first to draw on a map the outline of land and sea, and he constructed a globe as well," end quote. He is the first among the pre-Platonics who leaves behind written works. It is said in the descriptions of him that Anaximander carried himself with an overriding sense of grim seriousness in his words and his gestures. His countenance was always dour. He presented himself as though he were the hero within a truly tragic existence. This kind of personality type appears again and again among the Greek philosophers, and it seems that Anaximander is its prototypical exemplar. A tradition holds that Anaximander learned from Thales, but Nietzsche argues that there were no organized institutions of philosophy at that time, and such claims of lineage are probably not true. We can say, however, that Anaximander continued the work of Thales, likely through an oral tradition. He did this by continuing the same line of inquiry as Thales, namely the question, what exists? That is the central question of all the pre-Platonics, and Anaximander takes further great strides in this direction. Nietzsche says that he moved at a much faster pace than his fellow philosophers. Quote, Thales shows the need of simplifying the empire of plurality and of reducing it to a mere expansion or disguise of the one single existing quality, water. Anaximander goes beyond him. End quote. Perhaps the most famous utterance of Anaximander, containing the central idea of his philosophy, is this, quote, Whence things originated, thither, according to necessity, they must return and perish, for they must pay penalty and be judged for their injustices according to the order of time. End quote. Anaximander's judgment about reality is based on the observation that becoming and passing away seem to be the only perennial fact that obtains in the case of all individual phenomena. All things are transitory. Thales sees the plurality as transformations and rarefactions of one form of matter, an original unity. But Anaximander asks, why do these transformations occur at all? How can being arise and pass away? It should be noted that in Nietzsche's pre-Platonic lectures, Thales is not considered a main figure, as he lists him here in Philosophy in the Tragic Age of the Greeks. Instead, in his lectures, Nietzsche says that Thales is simply a forerunner to Anaximander, who gives the fuller expression of this idea that there is some fundament of reality, some original form of matter, some original form of being. Thales finds this in water, which is a form of matter that has definite qualities. Anaximander still affords a special position to water as the, quote, seaman of the world, end quote. And this is for the reasons that we talked about in the lecture on Thales, and that living things need water to survive. Water inseminates the soil so that plants grow out of it, and so on and so forth. But the further leap which Anaximander takes is to designate the fundamental form of being as something without definite qualities at all. He names it the apeiron, which means the indefinite. It is the origin of all things, which is itself qualityless. Apeiron could be translated many different ways, and we could perhaps elucidate different ways of thinking about it by considering the different ways that the word could be rendered into English. It is unlimited, unconditioned, qualityless, indefinite, undefined. It is that which is prior to all individual definite things, because all that which is defined is delimited. Every thing of which we have experience possesses defining attributes, which designate the thing as individual and differentiate it from everything else. All of these definite, limited, qualified phenomena are also transitory, as mentioned. They are finite, both in their extension as bodies in space, but also in the temporal nature of their existence. And so Anaximander does not suggest another form of matter as the basis of matter, but asks what all of the material things that we encounter have in common. He concludes that they all have limits. His epiphany is that the totality which is prior to them and the cause of them must be some form of being which is unlimited, undefined. Anaximander defines this indefinable thing as such, quote, the unlimited, embracing and governing all, being immortal and indestructible, end quote. It should be noted that Anaximander doesn't think that all things are contained within the apeiron. And it's not as if the apeiron has a definite quality of being indestructible. It is simply that the defining quality of being destructible does not apply to the apeiron any more than any other quality does. All limited things come from this limitless thing, all mortal things from the immortal, all destructible things from the indestructible, all things with qualities from the qualityless. Anaximander has taken us into true metaphysics for the first time. And he's not satisfied with an appeal to any phenomenon which appears in this world of arising and passing away as an answer to the mystery of existence. Neither the moist nor the hot could be the origin, because the moist and the hot will appear here and then disappear there. Things are moist 1 minute, and then they're dry the next. There's fire, and then the fire goes out. These phenomena are subject to change. And so no such transitory phenomenon can be the origin of the all, of existence itself, since all of these limited phenomena are part of that becoming which we're trying to explain. A single part cannot explain the whole. But Anaximander has not explained, up to this point, the reason for arising and passing away. And in the course of attempting to explain it, he introduces moralism into philosophy. This is because we must account for why anything should carve itself off from the indefinite in the first place. Why should anything incarnate as a separate limited being and not remain part of the qualityless origin? Nietzsche writes, quote, "How can anything perish that has a right to exist? Whence that restless becoming and giving birth? Whence that expression of painful distortion on the face of nature? Whence the never-ending dirge in all realms of existence?" End quote. The answer is that all which exists, in fact, has no right to its existence. That, in fact, its very existence is a crime, an injustice. Becoming, this very world of arising and passing away, this world of strife, is a punishment for the injustice of having stolen one's existence from the indefinite. Nietzsche writes, quote, "It may not be very logical. It is, however, at any rate very human, and moreover quite in harmony with the philosophical leaping described above. Now with Anaximander to consider all becoming as a punishable emancipation from eternal being, as a wrong that is to be atoned for by destruction. Everything that has once come into existence also perishes, whether we think of human life, or of water, or of heat and cold. Everywhere where definite qualities are to be noticed, we are allowed to prophesy the extinction of these qualities, according to the all-embracing proof of experience. Thus, a being that possesses definite qualities and consists of them can never be the origin and principle of things. The veritable ends, the existent, Anaximander concluded, cannot possess any definite qualities. Otherwise, like all other things, it would necessarily have originated and perished. In order that becoming may not cease, the primordial being must be indefinite. The immortality and eternity of the primordial being lies not in an indefiniteness and inexhaustibility, as usually the expounders of Anaximander presuppose, but in this, that it lacks the definite qualities which lead to destruction, for which reason it also bears its name, the indefinite. The thus labeled primordial being is superior to all becoming, and for this very reason, it guarantees the eternity and unimpeded course of becoming. This last unity in that indefinite, the mother womb of all things, can, it is true, be designated only negatively by man as something to which no predicate out of the existing world of becoming can be allotted, and might be considered a peer to the Kantian thing in itself. End quote. So, Anaximander's main idea is compared here to Kant by Nietzsche, insofar as the apeiron is exactly as unknowable, as indescribable as Kant's thing in itself, the noumenon. Anaximander has also been compared to Schopenhauer, who took Kant's distinction between thing in itself and appearance very seriously, and also philosophized with a sort of grim judgment upon existence. In fact, Schopenhauer comes to many of the same moral conclusions as Anaximander, that the source of all suffering is existence itself, and the negation of one's existence is thus the relief of suffering. For Anaximander, to be absorbed again into the indefinite is the recompense for having transgressed and the rectifying of the injustice against being. Nietzsche describes Anaximander's significance as consisting precisely in this moral narrative about the nature of being. The strife that we experience within becoming, the suffering and conflict and death and loss and tragedy of existence, is because of the crime that we committed against being, which ought to have remained in its natural state, quote unquote, as unmoving, unchanging, immortal, undefined, qualityless. In other words, dead. Non-existent, really. I mean, at least beyond any human conception of existence. Life is strife, and this is a consequence of life being stolen from non-life, unlife, that which does not possess the quality or definite aspect of being alive, from the totally undefined, unlimited origin. And so there's a kind of fault to existence itself, or a kind of guilt to existence. Becoming and its suffering is evidence of that guilt, and the persevering, unmoving, immortal nature of the Aperon is evidence of its true being. Nietzsche writes, quote, "Out of this world of injustice, of audacious apostasy from the primordial unity of things, an Eximander flees into a metaphysical castle, leaning out of which he turns his gaze far and wide, in order at last, after a pensive silence, to address to all beings this question, what is your existence worth? And if it is worth nothing, why are you there? By your guilt, I observe, you sojourn in this world. You will have to expiate it by death. Look how your earth fades. The seas decrease and dry up. The marine shell on the mountain shows you how much already they have dried up. Fire destroys your world even now. Finally, it will end in smoke and ashes. But again and again, such a world of transitoriness will ever build itself up. Who shall redeem you from the curse of becoming?" End quote. Anaximander, therefore, elaborates on the work of Thales. In one sense, he brings into focus the full complexity of the question, what exists, by inquiring after the reason for arising and passing away. In another sense, however, his central idea is entirely different from that of Thales, because there is nothing moralistic in Thales. Anaximander creates the moral interpretation of existence. Arising and passing away is explained through that principle of guilt and the recompense for that guilt. And yet Nietzsche describes a darkness following over the world of Greek philosophy as a result of this pessimistic worldview created by Anaximander. It is the darkness of ignorance falling over the Greek mind, which has further been darkened by Anaximander's dismal view of life as something faulty. For the mind still wonders, quote, "Yet why has not everything that has become perished long ago, since indeed quite an eternity of time has already gone by? Whence the ceaseless current of the river of becoming?" End quote. This question, inquiring after the apparent meaninglessness of existence and yet its eternal continuation, is a terrible one. It brings us almost fully into that pessimistic Schopenhauerian perspective. And yet that world is also rendered inexplicable. Why becoming, if the origin is unchanging being? For all the great leaps of Anaximander, this matter remains obscure from the Anaximandrian perspective. It is at this point that another such single-minded sage comes to the forefront. Heraclitus, circa 500 BC. Heraclitus was from Ephesus on the Anatolian Peninsula in modern-day Turkey. He was one of its leading citizens, but perhaps one of the most significant things that we know about the life of Heraclitus is that he voluntarily retired from public life and renounced Ephesus. As for why this happened, it is at least superficially a political dispute, but in truth, Heraclitus had a more profound and damning critique of the Ephesians as people. Because of the location of their city-state, the Ephesians had to cautiously manage their relationship to the Persians. Nietzsche tells us that while he was in public life, Heraclitus was, quote, "a merciless opponent of democratic parties," end quote. Among the Democrats in Ephesus, there were radical elements who wished to pursue a more aggressive posture to antagonize the Persians. Nietzsche writes, and this isn't in Philosophy in the Tragic Age of the Greeks, but he includes this detail in his pre-Platonic lecture notes, quote, "Heraclitus, like his friend Hermodorus, had probably counseled against reckless measures against the Persians, and both were decried as friends of the Persians, until Hermodorus was ostracized. Heraclitus left the city voluntarily, giving up his archonship. He subsequently resided in seclusion at the Temple of Artemis. End quote. Heraclitus lived, if not in total solitude, apart from the rest of society. He could sometimes be found playing knucklebones with the children. In one famous anecdote, some of the other leading Ephesians came to see him at the temple. As they gathered around him and stared in disbelief, he said, quote, "Why, you rascals, are you astonished? Is it not better to do this than to take part in your civic life?" End quote. Another detail that Nietzsche gets from Diogenes Laertius is something that Heraclitus said of his banishment. Quote, "The Ephesians would do well to end their lives, every grown man of them, and leave the city to beardless boys, for that they have driven out Hermodorus, the worthiest man among them, saying, 'We will have none who is worthiest among us, or if there be any such, let him go elsewhere and consort with others.'" End quote. This is the result of the Greek practice of ostracism, in which every year the polis would vote on some individual to banish. Nietzsche suggests in the essay Homer's Contest that they did this not out of fear of tyrants or out of spite, because even though such things certainly happened in the long history of the practice, this was not the original purpose or motivation behind ostracism. The point was to continue the agon, the social competition. If there was ever any individual that was too outstanding, that completely dominated in some way, a rhapsode so good that none of the other rhapsodes could even hold a candle to their performances, for example, the competition then for who would be the best rhapsode would stall out. So it's best to banish that person in order to continue the social contest. The result of this, however, is that over time the most ambitious, most accomplished people found themselves banished. Heraclitus sees the folly in this. He eventually sees the folly in the entirety of public life and the power games of politics. He perceives that those who are the best in any society will find themselves expelled or else hammered down by the swarm of mediocre people. This assessment of the way that the collective acts is influential on Nietzsche's thought. Heraclitus is so disgusted with this state of affairs that the opinion that would rise to ascendance over the minds of the majority would be that the polis ought to be more aggressive and reckless in their foreign policy, and that this opinion not only just wins out, but that they would then banish the rational, cool-headed people. Heraclitus is so repulsed by this that he simply banishes himself. This backstory is essential for understanding Heraclitus and his whole character, which fascinated Nietzsche almost as much as the Heraclitean philosophy. Heraclitus is regal and self-assured to the maximum degree. We might call it arrogance. He is solitary because, in all other men, he sees only childishness and error. Only within himself does he find the truth, and he speaks directly from his own intuitive certainty. He does not feel a dialectical responsibility to justify his philosophy to the many by means of logical persuasion. And he does not approach philosophy, as Thales or Anaximander did, as a scientific thinker. This is the power of Heraclitus's archetype, and his thought is directly tied to his being this unique type of person, standing aside from any sort of discipline or lineage of thinkers. Nietzsche writes in Philosophy in the Tragic Age of the Greeks, section 8, quote, "Heraclitus was proud, and if it comes to pride with a philosopher, then it is a great pride. His work never refers him to a public, the applause of the masses and the hailing chorus of contemporaries. To wander lonely along his path belongs to the nature of the philosopher. His talents are the rarest, in a certain sense the most unnatural and at the same time exclusive and hostile even toward kindred talents. The wall of his self-sufficiency must be of diamond, if it is not to be demolished and broken, for everything is in motion against him. His journey to immortality is more cumbersome and impeded than any other, and yet nobody can believe more firmly than the philosopher that he will attain the goal by that journey, because he does not know where he is to stand, if not on the widely spread wings of all time. For the disregard of everything present and momentary lies in the essence of the great philosophic nature. He has truth, The wheel of time may roll whither it pleases, never can it escape from truth. It is important to hear that such men have lived. Such men live in their own solar system. One has to look for them there. Of that feeling of solitude which permeated the Ephesian recluse of the Artemis Temple, one can only divine something when growing benumbed in the wildest mountain desert. No paramount feeling of compassionate agitation, no desire to help, heal, and save emanates from him. He is a star without an atmosphere. His eye directed blazingly inwards looks outward for appearance's sake only, extinct and icy. All around him, immediately upon the citadel of his pride, beat the waves of folly and perversity. With loathing, he turns away from them. But men with a feeling heart would also shun such a Gorgon monster as cast out of brass. Within an out-of-the-way sanctuary among the statues of gods, by the side of cold, composedly sublime architecture, such a being may appear more comprehensible. As a man among men, Heraclitus was incredible, and though he was seen paying attention to the play of noisy children, even then he was reflecting upon what man never thought of on such an occasion: the play of the great world-child Zeus. He had no need of men, not even for his discernments. He was not interested in all that which one might perhaps ascertain from them, and in what other sages before him had been endeavoring to ascertain. He spoke with disdain of such questioning, collecting, in short, historic men. "I sought and investigated myself," he said, with a word by which one designates the investigation of an oracle, as if he and no one else were the true fulfiller and achiever of the Delphic precept, "Know thyself." End quote. That is a beautiful section of Nietzschean prose, and I think it's a confession from Nietzsche of just how thoroughly he was indebted to this man. This is where Nietzsche found the highest archetype of the philosopher from his perspective. Out of all of these figures, Heraclitus is the archetype with whom Nietzsche identifies, the solitary thinker who seeks and investigates himself, who understands their own reason to be the final and ultimate authority. Perhaps with Heraclitus this is taken to an extreme that may be imprudent. You end up setting yourself at odds with everyone in society around you. You see no relevant wisdom in those around you whatsoever. This could be seen as one of the benefits of these single-minded sages. In being sculpted out of a single stone, they each become a sort of maximum, a limit case for a certain type of thought. In Heraclitus, we find something admirable, something desirable to emulate, and that he creates that diamond wall of self-sufficiency. Remember that great task of Ralph Waldo Emerson, for example, self-reliance. Heraclitus exhibits that same virtue. And for those of us who feel as though we are inhabiting a world ruled by childishness and folly, that sense of relying on oneself and trusting in one's own wisdom and one's own intuition as the final authority, that can be immensely valuable. Even though, admittedly, it is a dangerous path. It leaves you open to falling into error yourself, in which there will not be a corrective from the external world. Trust in yourself is both a wonderful thing and a dangerous thing. Now that we have established who Heraclitus is, we might return to the lingering question in the wake of Anaximander's philosophical project, and that is, why is there becoming instead of being? If becoming is a kind of punishment for stealing our existence from the indefinite, an injustice which will be settled by reabsorption into the infinite, why hasn't everything been reabsorbed? Why hasn't becoming long since come to an end? Why this endless river of becoming? Nietzsche explains how Heraclitus addresses this. Quote, "Heraclitus denied the duality of two quite diverse worlds." End quote. These two diverse worlds to which Nietzsche refers are being and becoming, or we might say the Kantian distinction of noumenon and phenomena, thing in itself and appearance, or to use Anaximandrian language, the world of the indefinite and the world of definite things. Nietzsche continues in the passage, quote, "He no longer distinguished a physical world from a metaphysical, a realm of definite qualities from a realm of indefinable indefiniteness. Now, after this first step, he could neither be kept back any longer from a still greater audacity of denying. He denied being altogether. For this one world which was left to him, shielded all round by eternal unwritten laws, flowing up and down in the brazen beat of rhythm, shows nowhere persistence, indestructibility, a bulwark in the stream. Louder than Anaximander, Heraclitus exclaimed, "I see nothing but becoming. Be not deceived. It is the fault of your limited outlook, and not the fault of the essence of things, if you believe that you see firm land anywhere in the ocean of becoming and passing. You need names for things, just as if they had a rigid permanence, but the very river in which you bathe a second time is no longer the same one which you entered before." End quote. That last sentence, of course, refers to one of the most famous of Heraclitus' aphorisms, "One does not step into the same river twice," suggesting something very profound. The river is not something that possesses being. The whole thought model of being would suggest that there is a sort of essence to the river, a river in itself, which exists independently of the phenomenal experience of the river, and in spite of whatever changes, momentary changes or transitoriness may exist in the expression or the phenomenal existence of the river, there's a sort of quote-unquote real thing there. There's some sort of river that actually exists, which is a definable thing with boundaries and limits that we can sort of grab onto with our perception and with our language. That there is a identity to the river. The trouble with positing such an essential identity to the river is the very fact that the river flows, it moves. The water that makes up the river is never the same from moment to moment. If it were the same water every moment, then it wouldn't be flowing, meaning it would not be a river. You can't ever break down the river into constituent parts and determine where the river starts and ends. Rivers shift and move over the course of centuries, decades even. Even though we think of the river as a thing, the river is simply the result of, for example, snowmelt from the mountains flowing downhill. The river is a happening rather than a thing. It's an event or a process rather than an essence. This is the sense in which Heraclitus rejects all being. He sees only becoming, only events, not things. These phenomena that arise and pass away have no underlying essence or identity to anchor them. So the reason why this river of becoming continues is because existence is not an injustice that must be rectified. There is no being, no limitless Aperon from which our existence was stolen. Our particular existence, our phenomenal existence, is in fact not even a reality that we can point to. It's just an event or a process. It's not as if we're a thing that carved itself off from being. The notion of the Aperon, the indefinite, the qualityless, indestructible being, is nothing more than a fiction, an error created by men of little discernment. There's no end to becoming because there's no beginning to becoming. The river of existence simply flows on endlessly. Accordingly, Heraclitus likens existence to fire. In a sense, perhaps more profound than Thales' assertion that all matter is a transformation of water. We might think of fire as something more akin to energy in our modern lexicon. Perhaps fire was the only example that Heraclitus had at hand to describe energy. There is some of that artfulness here, some of that poetry that constitutes the leap of the pre-Platonic philosopher. Fire comes into being and then disappears from being. While the wood or the fuel that one uses for fire clearly still exists, it transforms into something else, it becomes ashes, for example, the actual flame seems to just appear and then disappear, to be there one moment and then gone the next. It's a real-life demonstration of arising and passing away, of coming into being and then blinking out of being. Meanwhile, fire also dances around. It seems to flow, to leap, to swell, to dissolve. It's a bit unpredictable. It can be both destructive and creative, useful and catastrophic. has all of these elements that make it ideal as the allegory for what Heraclitus thinks the world is, which he puts forth famously in Fragment 30. Quote, "This universe, which is the same for all, has not been made by any god or man, but it has always been, is, and will be an ever-living fire, kindling itself by regular measures and going out by regular measures." End quote. So this world of transitory existence has always been, is, and will be, which means transitory existence is eternal. That which is indestructible is the world, this totality of becoming, becoming itself, we might say. This existence that's defined by arising and passing away. It's not that there is something in itself which is eternal. What we ascribe that eternal status to in Heraclitean philosophy is becoming itself, which means change itself. If the question from the beginning has been, what is, and we have proceeded by asking about the fundamental nature of matter, then about the origin of the different forms of matter, Heraclitus's answer is that what is this changeable existence. The answer is not found in some truth which is quote-unquote behind the world. Thales argued that out of the one came the many, out of one substance comes many different forms of existence. Heraclitus argues, quote, the one is the many, end quote. The identity of becoming, the essence or self-existence of becoming, is the fact that becoming is multiple. Change, movement, these concepts suggest or demand multiplicity. You could never have movement in an existence that consisted of a purely static, unchangeable being. And since Heraclitus denies this sort of being, the only suggestion of such an identity to all things is that they are governed by what Heraclitus calls logos, a law or reason, which we might consider something akin to what we would call the laws of nature. That if anything enduring exists, that law is what exists, and the character of that law is change. What is enduring is change. This Heraclitean view produces a very different conception of justice in relation to life and existence than the view of Anaximander. Anaximander says that it is on account of injustice that our lives consist of strife. And the Heraclitean view, quote, strife is justice, end quote. There is nothing inherently terrible about strife that makes it self-evidently a punishment against living things. In fact, since this living phenomenal existence is the very fabric of being, since becoming is being, that means that strife is part of the nature of that being, part of the logos that governs it. This is how Heraclitus arrives at the harsh notion that, quote, war is the father of all, end quote, because there is no higher authority or transcendental form of being which governs the phenomenal world. Rather, that the world is governed by laws which are internal to it, not imposed from above. Heraclitus sees that conflict is the natural pattern that apprehends in the world. The world is a play of forces, sometimes a dance, sometimes a battle. There's a creative aspect to this play, there's a destructive aspect to it, but it is play, something innocent, something which is not condemned by the strife that takes place within it. The metaphor that he uses is that of children playing. Fragment 52, quote, time is a child playing draughts. The kingly power is a child's, end quote. The spirit of the world is like the boy god Aeon, god of the zodiac, who plays innocently. This is not a theodicy. It's not a justification of the evil in the world, as we might say Anaximander engaged in. Rather, it's the refusal to justify the world at all. It's all just a game. Whatever pleasure or pain, sorrow or joy existed within the roil of that ever-living fire, it was not created to fulfill a somber morality tale. It simply happened. If we were to say that there is a divinity moving the world, we would say that this divinity did it all for fun, and that's that. Nietzsche writes in section 7, quote, Heraclitus is not compelled to prove, as Leibniz was, that this world was even the best of all. It was sufficient for him that the world is the beautiful, innocent play of the Aeon. Man, on the whole, is to him even an irrational being, with which the fact that in all his essence the law of all-ruling reason is fulfilled does not clash. He does not occupy a specially favored position in nature, whose highest phenomenon is not simple-minded man, but fire, for instance, as stars. Insofar as man has through necessity received a share of fire, he is a little more rational. As far as he consists of earth and water, it stands badly within his reason. He is not compelled to take cognizance of the Logos simply because he is a human being. Why is there water? Why earth? This, to Heraclitus, is a much more serious problem than to ask why men are so stupid and bad. In the highest and the most perverted men, the same inherent lawfulness and justice manifest themselves. If, however, one would ask Heraclitus the question, why is fire not always fire? Why is it now water, now earth? Then he would only just answer, it is a game. Don't take it too seriously, and still less, morally. Heraclitus describes only the existing world and has the same contemplative pleasure in it which the artist experiences when looking at his growing work. Only those who have cause to be disconcerted with his natural history of man find him gloomy, melancholy, tearful, somber, atrabilious, pessimistic, and altogether hateful. He, however, would take these discontented people, together with their antipathies and sympathies, their hatred and their love, as negligible, and perhaps answer them with some such comment as, quote, dogs bark at anything they do not know, or, quote, to the ass, chaff is preferable to gold, end quote. Those last two remarks that Nietzsche cites are among Heraclitus's most quotable aphorisms, and they indicate that from a given perspective, a phenomena could be experienced differently than it might be from the perspective of another type of being. A dog barks at anyone they don't know, meaning if a person walks into a room, I mean, even if the dog can't see the person, you know, the dog can smell them, right? The dog will react differently depending on whether they smell a familiar person or a total stranger. Or the donkey prefers straw to gold. Presumably, human beings would prefer gold to straw because we use gold in our economic system. Gold can buy you quite a bit of straw as well as other things that you might want. But there's no inherent value to gold that makes it better than straw. Its value is given to it by human beings. It has no value at all to the donkey, who would prefer the straw that it can actually eat. This is, in roughly 500 BC, a perspectivist approach to philosophy. Heraclitus is saying, you invest phenomena with the values that they have. Things have the sense and value that they have based on who and what you are, not based on some quality inherent to the object. The object is not valuable in and of itself. Gold is not valuable in and of itself. If a dog barks at one person and not another, it's not because the first person was bad and the second person was good. It just means the dog knows one person and he doesn't know the other person. He has an association with one, but not the other. This may seem like a minor or even an obvious point, but this is the real consequence of denying being. There are no inherent qualities to things, only what we give them. This even applies to the way we sense the thing and experience it, because sensation itself occurs at the intersection of the object with our sense organs. It depends on our sense organs such that we're able to represent the object to ourselves. These insights would be profoundly important to countless philosophers of the continental tradition and afterwards, from Hegel to Nietzsche to Deleuze to Heidegger. All in all, Heraclitus leaves us with a world which is the game of Aeon or Zeus, however we want to name the supreme deity. It's a perspective on life which makes primary the embodied living world. Of all the pre-Platonics, Nietzsche seems to see the greatest enduring value in Heraclitus. Nietzsche writes, quote, the world needs truth eternally. Therefore she needs also Heraclitus eternally, although he has no need of her. What does his fame matter to him? Fame with mortals ever flowing on, as he exclaims scornfully. His fame is of concern to man, not to himself. The immortality of mankind needs him, not he the immortality of the man Heraclitus. That which he beheld, the doctrine of the law and the becoming, and of the play in the necessity, must henceforth be beheld eternally. He has raised the curtain of this greatest stage play. End quote. Of course, the philosophical dialogue of the pre-Platonics is far from over. Having seemingly eliminated static being from the discourse with his philosophy of becoming, Heraclitus was destined to remain an obscure figure. It is simply not the kind of assertion that the ordinary people with their lack of discernment will be able to believe in. And meanwhile, another philosopher, with whom he was a contemporary, a man from Elea, began an entire school in which being would return with a vengeance. This figure, Parmenides, takes the inverse stance of Heraclitus and denies becoming. The Eleatic school of Parmenides is the topic that will begin our next episode. Parmenides' conception of being will be profoundly influential on Plato and countless others to come. He is the next significant voice in this narrative. I hope you'll join me then for the continuation of Philosophy in the Tragic Age of the Greeks in our examination of Parmenides, Anaxagoras, Empedocles, and Democritus. Thank you so much for listening, everyone. Signing off. If you enjoyed the Nietzsche podcast or found it helpful, you can visit us and support the show at patreon.com/untimelyreflections. The link is in the description. Or just share the show with any of your friends that you think might enjoy it or on social media. Thank you for your support.